I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today on Midday, the status of the stalled Israeli-Palestinian peace process. In April, Benjamin Netanyahu won his fourth consecutive election as Israel's prime minister, but he was unable to form a government, so Israeli voters will have to return to the polls again in mid-September. Controversial comments over the weekend by the American ambassador to Israel supporting Netanyahu's pledge to annex Jewish settlements on the West Bank cast further doubt on the prospects for a peace plan developed by Jared Kushner. My guest today, Natan Sachs, the director of the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, Martin Indyk, former U.S. ambassador to Israel, Shibli Telhami of the University of Maryland, and Jerome Siegel, the president of the Jewish Peace Lobby. Midday on the Middle East starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us today. Today, an update on what's going on in Israeli politics and the status of the stalled Middle East peace process. Next month, Benjamin Netanyahu will surpass David Ben-Gurion as Israel's longest-serving prime minister. In April, Netanyahu won his fourth consecutive and fifth overall election. But Netanyahu is by no means basking in electoral glory. He is locked in a battle with Israel's attorney general, who is considering indicting Netanyahu in three criminal cases. And to the surprise of many, the prime minister and his Likud party were unable to form a coalition government, as he finds himself at loggerheads with a former defense minister in a disagreement about mandatory military conscription for Orthodox Jews. In an interview with the New York Times on Saturday, U.S. Ambassador to Israel David Friedman said, quote, "Under certain circumstances, I think Israel has the right to retain some, but unlikely all, of the West Bank," referring to Netanyahu's pledge to begin efforts to annex Jewish settlements in the West Bank. Friedman's comments appeared to signal American endorsement of a policy that is in violation of international law and which could end hopes for a two-state solution of the long-standing conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. Meanwhile, in Washington, a peace plan devised by President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, appears to be on hold until after the 2020 American presidential election, although parts of it are scheduled to be unveiled at a conference in Bahrain later this month. For analysis and context, we'll begin today with Natan Sachs. He's a fellow and the director of the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He joins us on the line from studios at Brookings in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Mr. Sachs. Good to talk to you.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
And listeners, if you'd like to join our conversation, we'll take your calls in a little bit, but our email, midday@wypr.org, and you can drop us a tweet at @midday_WYPR. So I wonder, Mr. Sachs, if we could begin by your explaining what's happened in terms of Netanyahu's inability to form a coalition government. He wins the election in April. What did he need to form a viable coalition, and why didn't he get it?
Well, in Israel, Israeli politics, everything is always unprecedented and stunning and dysfunctional, but this really was all those things. Netanyahu seemed to have a decisive victory in April. The coalition, or the coalition he hoped to have, had 65 seats out of 120, so not a huge majority, but a comfortable one. And then he entered what should have been rather regular process of forming a coalition among the different parties that would grant him a majority in the Knesset, the Israeli parliament. He got the mandate from the Israeli president, who's mostly a functional role, and then he hit a very surprising roadblock. Avigdor Lieberman, his former partner but also rival, seemed to refuse to budge on demands that made it very, very hard for Netanyahu to bridge between Lieberman and the ultra-Orthodox parties in the Knesset. This seems to be a facade. What really is going on is a battle over Netanyahu's personal future. In theory, by Israeli law, if Netanyahu fails to form a government, someone else would have been tasked with the job. Any other member of the Knesset could be the prime minister, being tasked by the president to do so. It could have even been a member of his own party, the Likud, which ostensibly won the elections. To prevent all that, Netanyahu went to new elections, really unprecedented, and called them for September 17th. And the reason is, first, he doesn't want to give up the post, even if someone else in his own party could do it, as the law would require. And secondly, he needs the Knesset to pass a form of immunity for himself, for him to stay out of jail and out of prison As you mentioned, he's facing 3 indictments by the Attorney General. He needs to change the law to enable himself to get out of that.
And there's a calendar issue as well here. The Attorney General, Avichai Mandelblit, is considering indicting Prime Minister Netanyahu on, as we said, three separate criminal cases. And there is a pre-indictment hearing scheduled. It was scheduled for July, I guess, right, for next month. Now it's been moved to beginning of October. It looks like Mr. Netanyahu is headed to the highest court in Israel today to see if he can delay it even further. What's the status of that?
It's the irony of all ironies. Netanyahu, what he's really trying to do legally is to change the process of judicial review, to limit the ability of the Supreme Court to oversee decisions by the Knesset. And why? Because he would like to go to the Knesset and get immunity, something which he can do by law. But then usually the Supreme Court would intervene and say it's unreasonable in this case. There's no justified reason to give immunity for someone for corruption charges. He wants to prevent the Supreme Court from having the power to do that. And now, here's the irony, he might go to the Supreme Court to overturn the decision of the Attorney General to hold the hearing on the time, the rescheduled hearing for the beginning of October. The hearing, we should say, is sort of a last opportunity for Netanyahu and his lawyers to go before the Attorney General. Then the Attorney General will make his final decision. He's already tentatively decided to indict Netanyahu on three different cases, including charges of bribery for one of these cases. The hearing might change his mind. It seems rather unlikely. But that is in essence the core of the hearing. Now, even if the hearing is held as scheduled in October, Netanyahu may have the time to pass the legislation he needs to get out of it. By the time the Attorney General reviews all the material he had in the hearing, we're probably talking about December when he makes his final decision. By then, a new Knesset will have been formed, and if Netanyahu wins, as he won in April, or seemed to win in April, then he could form a coalition, and one of the elements of the agreement with the coalition partners would be to allow him to get out of this mess, which is a very troubling issue. This is crossing a Rubicon, crossing a path that you cannot go back on by limiting judicial review for the purpose of one person's legal fate. It's a very troubling prospect.
What about what happens to this other issue, which you, as you've mentioned and others have commented as well, it could be sort of a cover for what's really going on here, which is about these criminal indictments. But what about this issue of whether or not members of the Orthodox community should be required to serve in the military? What goes away about that? What do you expect would happen on that score in this next round of elections scheduled for September 17th?
Well, I hate to be the cynical one, but this is a case, or the beauty or perhaps the ugliness of politics, where it's not at all the topic that people are pretending to speak about. Since the beginning of the state, there is, in theory, general universal conscription for Israelis, but that includes 2 very important communities. One is Arab citizens of Israel who are not required to join the military, which often fights their own people, and ultra-Orthodox, who got out of, was a very small community in the beginning and got out of that service so as to preserve the small world of ultra-Orthodox yeshivas that was decimated in the Holocaust. Since then, that community has grown dramatically, and now we're talking about many thousands of young men who don't join purely for political power reasons. This is something that many of people have demanded that change, and Lieberman is using that tool at the moment. But just to be clear, the law that he is demanding pass would not actually conscript most of these young men. It would produce a situation where there's a legal cover and some of them may be conscripted. It would not dramatically change the current situation. He is, however, using this as a political tool to appear in a new niche, or a niche that he's had in the past and has lost to a certain degree, which is right-wing but also secular. And that's a niche that has some real power, especially among his base, and he is looking for a political base. The issue of conscription is completely on hold. There was real change in 2013 when there was a government without the ultra-Orthodox parties, but they are back in government. They would be in a new Netanyahu coalition, and he failed to form one exactly because of that. And I would bet they are likely to be in the next coalition as well, unless we see a very different configuration of a national unity government.
You wrote a piece in The Atlantic a couple months ago in which you described Mr. Netanyahu's approach to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as an anti-solutionist approach. What do you mean by that?
What I mean is that Netanyahu and many of his supporters, and they're the base, he's been the prime minister now 5 terms, and this was his 4th victory, consecutive victory. They're constantly asked, what do you propose? If it's not a two-state solution, if it's not something that the left wing in Israel supports, then what do you want? And they will often turn the question on its head and say, the problem is in the question. They would say, and of course I'm paraphrasing dramatically, would say, you naive Americans who think you can solve everything in the world, that everything has a neat solution to it. You're going to come in and you're trying to devise a plan and split the buck down the middle and everyone will be happy. And their approach is cynical, perhaps, saying, no, there simply is no solution to many problems. Many problems are chronic, in medicine as well. And with those problems, what you need to do is manage them long term. And they see solutionism, in fact, as a problem because they think trying to solve these things causes some of the problems. Instead, we should focus on managing. And Netanyahu has been the master of this management. I'll point out one glaring problem, of course, with this approach. It makes sense if what you're trying to do is be rather conservative, keep your options open, limit the damage in the short term, and see if in the long term you can progress towards a better situation. But the status quo that Netanyahu presides over is not static at all. It's going in a very particular direction, a direction that brings the West Bank into Israel proper and prevents the possibility of partition in the future. In that sense, it's not anti-solutionist. It's leading towards a specific solution that Netanyahu views and one that I think would be very dangerous. But it is not purely a conservative approach as he presents it to be.
And that is essentially what's called a one-state solution. You are not at all sanguine about the prospects for a two-state solution with a Palestinian and an Israeli independent state.
I'm not sanguine, but I should say the one-state solution is an oxymoron. It's no solution at all. There's a one-state reality that could emerge, one that would be extremely troubling and very prone to civil war. It's not a solution in any means. You're simply taking the same elements of the conflict, and instead of leaving open the possibility of a political solution among two people that have very different conceptions of themselves and history and their political aspirations, you'd be bringing them into one country. It's in a sense of form trying to reform Yugoslavia in worse conditions and hoping for the best. So in that sense, it is very dangerous. Netanyahu has a slightly different view of how this would be. He doesn't think he's bringing in the whole West Bank. He doesn't think he's bringing in the Gaza Strip. He thinks he could maintain Israel separate from most of the Palestinians. I think he's quite wrong in the way he views this, but that is his approach. And the important point about his anti-solutionist view is that although I think it's wrong, it's not completely absurd. It is fair to say that it is rather difficult to reach a two-state solution. I think we have to keep the option open. We have to make sure the status quo is not sliding away from it. But it is not crazy to say you don't always want to rush towards a solution immediately. Sometimes you have to think about what's available at hand right now. And it's an interesting point, especially when you think of the Trump administration's attempt right now. They're trying to go headfast towards this grand vision of peace when they themselves are undermining the possibility in the short term, creating a situation where a solution right now is simply not available.
And I know we have to let you go in just a minute, but I do want to have you, before you leave, sort of gauge public opinion in Israel. In your piece in The Atlantic, you cite a study by the Israeli Democracy Institute that said 63% of Jewish Israelis, and that represents about 80% of the population, self-define as being right or center-right. The Labor Party was one of the night's biggest losers in the election in April. In terms of public support for Netanyahu, given his indictment possibilities, etc., where do you think it stands?
Yes, this is a long-term phenomenon in Israel. We've seen at least a decade, in fact more, of the right wing being very strong. And the right wing in Israel does not mean necessarily small government and many other things we mean in the United States. It means mostly hawkishness about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the Arab-Israeli conflict more generally. But this hawkishness is mostly focused on security threats, on the fear that giving in or being more compromising would threaten Israeli security and the security of Israeli citizens. In that regard, Israelis have become much more right-wing, especially since the failure of the second Camp David summit in 2000 and the outbreak of the Intifada, and afterwards the aftermath of the disengagement from Gaza. These seem to shatter the proposals or the basic stance of the left in Israel and then the center with the disengagement. In that way, the right-wing has gained a lot. But that does not mean that the right wing would not be open to quite a bit of compromise, or that all people who consider themselves right wing are right wing in every sense. Moreover, if you think of the left and the center, today people don't use the term left as much. It's considered to be a bad word in Israel to a degree. But many of the people who used to call themselves left are now center, and to a degree the same kind of proposals are there. So this is important. This data is important. But first, we must add, of course, 20% of the population who are not Jewish, and they would define themselves not quite as left. It means something slightly different to them, but they'd certainly be on the left side of the map. So if you look at election results, they're very consistent. The last ones at 65 for the right wing and 55 to the center left. That's a clear victory for the right, but it's not an overwhelming one. It's not destiny. It doesn't mean Netanyahu is invincible. It does mean he's a very successful politician, of course, and that majority of Israelis have supported him time and time again in recent history. His biggest challenge, of course, as you said in the beginning, his biggest challenge now will be legal. Can he stay out of prison, and can he manipulate the political system to do so, to keep him a free man?
Natan Sachs is the director of the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. Mr. Sachs, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
We'll have more on the Middle East when we come back from a quick break. We'll turn next to former U.S. Ambassador to Israel and Middle East Special Envoy Martin Indyk, as well as Shibli Telhami. He's a Middle East scholar on the faculty of the University of Maryland, and they'll join us in just a minute. You are welcome to join us as well. 410-662-8780. That's our number here at Midday. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, it's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks of the Maryland Institute College of Art. We're going to talk about summer camps. What are your kids doing this summer? Well, the way you answer that question may have as much to do with social class as anything else. Sherry and I will be joined by Shireen at Christmas, who spends part of her summer taking kids on international trips to explore their African heritage. We'll hear about the Scholars of Muse 360 Arts tomorrow on Midday. If you've just joined us today, we're talking about Israeli and Palestinian politics and prospects for peace in the Middle East. We turn now to Martin Indyk. He's the former ambassador to Israel during the Clinton administration. He's now a distinguished fellow on the Council of Foreign Relations, and he joins us from his home in New York. Mr. Ambassador, welcome, sir.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Shibli Telhami joins us as well. He's the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland. He's also served as a senior advisor to the U.S. State Department, an advisor to the U.S. mission to the United Nations, and he's a non-resident scholar at the Brookings Institution, and he joins us from the Brookings studio in Washington, D.C. Dr. Telhami, welcome as well.
My pleasure.
And listeners, our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. Mr. Ambassador, let me first ask you for your reaction to the current ambassador to Israel, David Friedman. He gave an interview to the New York Times the other day, and he said, quote, "Under certain circumstances, I think Israel has the right to retain some, but unlikely all, of the West Bank." This comes in the context of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's promise to begin annexing Jewish settlements in the West Bank. That's a move that most folks think is a violation of international law. What do you make of that?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to note that the U.S. ambassador to Israel doesn't just wake up in the morning and decide to give an interview to the New York Times. I don't know whether he cleared it with Washington or whether he thought it unnecessary, but there's no question that this is a major intervention, and it comes at a particularly delicate time when Trump's envoys, Jared Kushner and Jason Greenblatt, are trying to convince Palestinian businessmen and Arab governments to join in the Bahrain workshop that they're putting together as the first step in their unveiling of their much-awaited Trump peace plan. And this is incendiary language that Ambassador Friedman has used, talking about Israel's right to annex, not the possibility but the right to an X, which is understood, and you know, since you followed this for a long time, that when you use words like this in the context of the Arab-Israeli conflict, that they have a powerful resonance. And so to combine the right to annex with the word annex is really throwing this kind of firebomb at a very delicate moment. When the Palestinians feel hard put upon by all the actions that punitive actions that the Trump administration has taken against them. And now they find the U.S. ambassador to Israel saying that on top of all of that, Israel has a right to annex territory which they regard as theirs by right to form their Palestinian state.
And Dr. Telhami, the reaction to that statement in the Arab world?
Well, you know, let's start before the reaction. Obviously, the statement is one that goes against not only international law but previous American positions. But, I mean, you know, I'm not sure it was even a delicate moment in the sense that I don't think the Trump plan as specified so far and the effort as we understand it so far has any chance whatsoever with or without Friedman to succeed. It's almost dead on arrival and maybe, in fact, designed for the Palestinians to reject it in the first place so as to set up possible Israeli unilateralism, including annexation. I think we really need to think about the absurdity of the whole situation. In fact, the way that we're talking about it is a normal thing. You have essentially three individuals who are scandalously inexperienced from the real estate industry with no previous knowledge of the Middle East, known for advocating far-right positions on this issue that are illegal according to international law and at odds with the positions of every previous American administration, essentially given the key of a superpower to use the assets of the superpower, the most powerful nation on earth, in attempt to fulfill their ideological aspirations, apparently. And so the idea that we are really in a normal, quote, peace process now and that has any shot, no matter what Friedman says or not, I think is I don't see it that way. I just see that there is no chance at all that this effort could possibly lead to an agreement or something that the Palestinians could accept.
And to be clear, Dr. Telhami, the three individuals you're talking about are Jared Kushner, David Friedman, and Mr. Greenblatt or Mr. Trump
That's
himself?
Right. No, Jason Greenblatt. I mean, they're the three men who, of course, were in Trump's real estate world, both legally and investment-wise, and obviously with Kushner being the son-in-law in addition to that. They really had no previous experience with the Arab world. Certainly, they've connected to Israel and mostly ideologically, known for their pro-settlement positions, David Friedman being a fundraiser for settlements before and being contributors to settlements, have always felt that settlements that were seen illegal by international law and certainly illegitimate by previous administrations, you know, they were always at odds with it. And clearly that policy is echoing their positions right now. And in essence, they're the ones who were given the authority to make policy on this issue.
And Ambassador Indyk, what do you make of that, given the fact that these individuals are the ones proposing some sort of resolution to this longstanding Israeli-Palestinian conflict? There is a workshop scheduled for the end of this month in Bahrain. They're not going to, as I understand it, unveil the political part of that plan, but they do want to talk about the economic part of that plan. Given their personal histories, Mr. Friedman, a donor to settlements, as Dr. Telhami has just mentioned, we've got Jason Greenblatt and Kushner themselves both seemed as completely pro-Israel rather than approaching this in any sort of balanced way. What can the United States do to earn the credibility and trust of Palestinians in this process?
Oh, I think that's long gone. Too much water under the bridge for them to redeem any credibility with the Palestinians. They seem to have in their minds that they're really the Palestinian common man or the Palestinian common businessman is out there just waiting for an opportunity to get all this promises of funding for economic development and prosperity for the Palestinian territories, and that somehow by waving this kind of pot of gold in front of them, it's going to convince them to join in their efforts. Indeed, Ambassador Friedman, in this interview in the New York Times yesterday, went to pains to try to split Palestinian leadership from Palestinian people, berating the Palestinian leadership, saying they were the problem, and that the Palestinian people that he had spoken to really wanted to go forward. This is part of an effort, I think, on their part to split the Palestinian people from the Palestinian leadership. It's a tactic that is, I think, bound to fail, and we're about to discover that when we see whether any Palestinian businessmen actually turn up at the Bahrain workshop at the end of this month. But there's other thing I'd like to say about these three musketeers. They're not all of one mind. As you correctly identify, Ambassador Friedman is very much of one mind with the settler agenda in Israel, and he's made no bones about that. And as ambassador to Israel, somebody who has a direct line of communication with the president, he has gone out of his way to pursue that agenda. I think Jared Kushner has a different agenda. I don't think he had it in mind that he would be the peacemaker. The job was foisted on him by his father-in-law without consultation. But his purpose, I think, is to try to find a way to use the peace process to generate greater support, either amongst evangelicals, part of his father-in-law's fundamental political base, or with American Jews, to support President Trump in his re-election bid, and to show that Trump has moved the embassy to Jerusalem, has recognized Israel's sovereignty on the Golan Heights, and now, as part of this effort with peace plan, has done away with the two-state solution, that this is a reason why evangelicals and American Jews should support him. The third one, Jason Greenblatt, is, I think, actually genuinely committed to trying to find a way to forward in very difficult circumstances, but I just don't think he has the Jews to do so, given the positions of these other two members of the team.
Well, if I may, on this issue, I mean, obviously what Martin articulated is very plausible, and it's possible. And I go back and forth in my own mind what is driving Trump's advisor and Trump himself on this issue. It's obviously something that's debatable. But here, I want to put a different kind of possible argument here. First, with regard to the Palestinian people with leadership on the economic part. I mean, Trump's advisor would have to be extraordinarily naive to think that the Palestinian people believe that they have their interest at heart when they've done what they've done, including cutting off aid and the humanitarian consequences of that, and cutting aid to the refugees through UNRWA and so forth. And regardless, I think there's such mistrust that it would be silly to believe that they even are so naive as to believe that. And so one possibility is that they believe that, and they are really that naive. I guess that's possible. The other possibility, this is a cynical use, just trying to pretend like they have had an attempt essentially to rationalize what ultimately might be unilateral Israeli moves, and essentially persuade Arab Gulf states who want to cooperate with Israel, particularly on the Iran issue, and obviously Trump wants them to, and so does the Israeli government, to give them essentially a rationalization for doing so. And therefore, it's really designed to look like they're making an effort when, in fact, they're doing everything they can to get a no from the Palestinians. As for, you know, what's driving them domestically, I mean, obviously, Martin is right in the sense that these efforts have been popular among certain constituencies of Trump's base, particularly evangelicals. I'm writing a book on the evangelicals in Israel, and I've been doing tremendous research. I don't think the evangelicals rank and file really sort of driven by this issue as much as people think. They're supportive of Israel, but they don't know what it – if the leaders told them, well, we shouldn't move the embassy now, they would have supported Trump anyway. And Trump has given them everything they need, on particularly with religious schools and cuts and Supreme Court appointments, more than any other president has given them in the past. That on this issue, I don't think that would have been the driving force. And I think more likely, again, you know, the plan is designed if, in addition to, you know, rationalizing what Israel might do in the absence of a deal, really kind of anchor this relationship between Israel and the Gulf Arab states, particularly Saudi Arabia, which is at the core of the strategy vis-a-vis Iran and regionally.
And Ambassador Indyk, what about the narrative that says that were the Palestinians to reject the Kushner-Greenblatt peace plan out of hand, that plays right into the hand of Bibi Netanyahu and Donald Trump, and it just sort of leaves little or no options after that. I mean, you mentioned the possibility that at this summit in just a couple of weeks, members of the Palestinian business community may not even show up. How would one move forward were that to be the case?
Well, I think that Ambassador Friedman's interview to the New York Times yesterday may well have been designed to try to ensure that the Palestinians don't show up. That sounds awfully cynical, but I find it hard to explain why he would have done what he did yesterday at the time that he did. But whether they don't come as a result of his actions or don't come because they simply are not prepared to engage in this kind of process that offers them economic peace or the mirage of it, but no political progress on the issues that they care about in terms of their right to national self-determination, I think that it will be very convenient to be able to say that Palestinians yet again missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity, which is Zabeh Aban, former Israeli foreign minister's famous phrase that always gets trotted out at moments like these. They were the ones who missed the opportunity, and that now opens the way for the changing of the conversation, which is what Jared Kushner said is their objective with this peace plan. That is to say, they can say, well, Palestinians rejected it, so now we're going ahead with Netanyahu, if he can form a government, on the course of redefining the very basis of negotiation. Since there's no chance of any peace plan, let's give up on the two-state solution. Let's recognize realities as they exist on the ground. Jerusalem is Israel's. Settlements are going to stay. The Israeli army has to be in the West Bank forever. And refugees are not going home to places that don't exist in Israel anymore. And I think that is the may well be the broader purpose of what they're trying to do here, which is to achieve a kind of fundamental shift, certainly in American policy, but in the whole conversation about what constitutes a settlement of the Palestinian issue.
Dr. Martin Indyk is a former U.S. ambassador to Israel, as well as a special envoy to the Middle East. He was ambassador during the Clinton administration and the envoy during the Obama administration. He's now a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Dr. Shibli Talhami is on the faculty of the University of Maryland. He's also a non-resident senior fellow in the Project on U.S. Relations with the Islamic World and the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. They'll stick with us when we come back from a break, and we'll also be joined then by Jerome Siegel. He's a former research scholar at the Center for International Security Studies at the University of Maryland and the president of the Jewish Peace Lobby. To join our conversation here on Midday, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. You can follow me on Twitter at @TomHallWYPR. Before we take that break, on Mondays here on Midday, it's our practice to read the names of the people who've lost their lives to violence in Baltimore in the previous week. We do so to stand in witness to their untimely deaths, and we remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far in 2019, 133 people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence. Police have released the identities of three victims of homicide whose deaths were first reported the week before last. They are Andre Davis, age 25, Cody Bonner, age 22, and Donnie Walton, age 54. This past week, Police reported 5 people lost their lives to violence in our city. They are Aaron Lemon, age 40, Meredith Perry, age 25, Ramon Manley, age 27, Gerald Brown III, age 34, and Antoine Knight. He was 17 years old. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. And welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, it's midday on the Middle East today. Benjamin Netanyahu won election to a 5th term as Prime Minister of Israel last April, but he was unable to form a government, and he'll have to stand for election again in September. So what will that mean for the Likud party, for the right wing in Israel, and for the peace process? And what's next for the Palestinian Authority and the prospects of a Palestinian state? The fate of East Jerusalem? And how will the peace process proceed when Jared Kushner, Donald Trump's son-in-law, releases a part of a peace plan later this month? It's midday on the Middle East, and my guests are Shibli Telhami, the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland, Ambassador Martin Indyk. He served as U.S. Ambassador to Israel during the Clinton administration and as the Special Envoy for Israeli-Palestinian negotiations in 2013 and 14 during the Obama administration. And we're joined now by Jerome Siegel. He's the president of the Jewish Peace Lobby. Mr. Siegel ran against Ben Cardin in the 2018 Democratic senatorial primary. He has recently published an essay in a Palestinian newspaper as well as The Medium, in which he suggests ways forward after the Trump administration releases its Middle East peace plan, which Mr. Trump refers to as, quote, the deal of the century. You are welcome to join our conversation on midday, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR. Dr. Siegel, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You wrote this piece that was published in, as I mentioned, a Palestinian newspaper as well as an online journal here in the United States, saying, as some of our guests have stated earlier in this program, that it's very possible that these comments by Ambassador Friedman over the weekend were designed, in fact, to have the Palestinians reject any Kushner peace proposal out of hand. You don't think that's a good idea? Why not?
Yeah, well, I think the Palestinians, to some extent, are being set up. Initially, I thought that they would put forward the plan with the expectation that the Palestinians would reject it, and then the Israelis, the Israeli right-wing government, would maintain further proof that there's no partner on the other side, and that would lay the basis for the beginning of a process of annexation, which I think we've all agreed is a disaster. Now I'm not even convinced that the plan is ever going to see light of day because of the elections, and the annexation thing is now taken on a life of its own. But I think that what we have here for the Palestinians actually is a great opportunity, either in contrast to the Trump plan or if the Trump plan never even surfaces. It's an opportunity to the Palestinians to redefine themselves by putting forward something that they actually have never done, which is in detail their own plan. That is, to actually lay something out in full detail that they are prepared to sign. And I've had some conversations with them. I've written about this in the Palestinian press. I've explored one process, actually, that I developed with a former Israeli foreign minister, Shlomo Ben Ami, which was to go to the UN and have the General Assembly reconvene UNSCOP, the commission that drafted the petition resolution of 47, and then have that, what they come up with, be the basis for renewed negotiations. But now I think even more powerful would be if the Palestinians simply came forward with something that they were prepared to sign, and they could take off the shelf, maybe tweak it a bit. But there was in 2002, in full detail, something called the Geneva Initiative that was drafted by Israeli forces on the left, And on the Palestinian side, people who were not representing formally the PLO but had previously had positions in the PLO. This is in total, full detail, almost a ready-to-be-signed agreement. They could take that, they could tweak it, and they could say to the Israelis, we're prepared to sign this or put this to a referendum if you are. It would be transformational if they did that.
Dr. Talhami, as Ambassador Indyk mentioned earlier in our conversation, when it comes to the Trump-Netanyahu partnership, perhaps just simply trying to completely change the parameters of these negotiations, what do you see as the chances that the Palestinians might do what Dr. Siegel is suggesting, coming up with a whole new way of changing it back to a way that they would like to see?
I don't really see it. It's not. First of all, I don't give advice to Palestinian leadership. They do what they do. So I'm looking at it mostly as a scholar of this issue, to see whether it even has a chance that any Palestinian leader would do that at this point. First of all, I'm not sure. Even if they were to do that, I'm not sure that it would be transformative at all. I think that it will. The Trump administration as well as the Israeli government would find a way to turn it all around, and the Palestinians don't have the upper hand in the narrative world. I mean, they're really kind of on the defensive constantly, and they don't have the resources and the ability to control the American narrative. And really, the Israelis and the Trump administration are not winning the global narrative. Let's keep that in mind. I mean, the narrative in Arab public opinion is not being won by the Trump administration. The Israelis' narrative in Europe is not being won by Netanyahu and the Trump administration. So the only game really is being played for narrative is both to justify the moves within Israel itself and in the U.S. So the game for Trump and Netanyahu is principally a game in Israel among the Jewish citizens principally and in the U.S. And in those communities, I just don't see this to be possibly transformational. I think it would obviously is not what this administration wants to do. It's not what Netanyahu wants to do. I don't see it.
And Ambassador Indyk, what about the decision by Mr. Kushner, Mr. Greenblatt, to unveil just part of their plan at the workshop in Bahrain later this month? They say they're going to put aside for the moment the political ramifications of an Israeli-Palestinian agreement and concentrate on the economic dimensions of it. In parsing it up that way, what do you make of that strategy?
Well, I believe that their calculation was that by coming up with the economic dimension first, they could generate some interest and even some traction to the idea of a kind of reconciliation process that would then create a better environment for putting down the political plan. That was, of course, before Netanyahu let them down in failing to put together his government after President Trump had intervened mightily on his behalf. And so I think that now, as Jerome said, there's a real question about whether the political dimension of the plan will ever see the light of day. And if the economic plan is just hanging out there on its own, then there's no chance that it's going to go anywhere because the Arab donors, particularly the Gulf states of Saudi Arabia, the Emirates and Qatar, will not pitch in significant money if there's not some kind of political process as well. So I think they find themselves now in an awkward position, made more so, as I said, by the interview by Ambassador Friedman talking about Israeli annexation, which puts the Arabs in an even more difficult position as they contemplate going to the Bahrain workshop. Egypt and Jordan have yet to say whether they are going to go. And interestingly, in the news this morning, Israel hasn't received an invitation. And that appears to be because Kushner was hoping to get more Arabs signed up before they announced that Israel was going. And they seem to now have a real problem there. So I think that overall, they are finding it very heavy going, which is not surprising. But the fact that they don't have the major Arab players signed up, that is to say Egypt and Jordan, the countries that are at peace with Israel. And there's no indication that any Palestinian businessmen are going to go, except for one renegade from Hebron. I think there's now a big question mark over the whole enterprise.
Yeah, and Dr. Siegel, to that point, I mean, in terms of getting Palestinian buy-in to some new alternative idea, I mean, what gives you confidence that that could happen?
Well, confidence isn't exactly it, but I've had, unlike Shibley, I've been telling the Palestinian leadership and speaking directly to Palestinian public through their newspapers and so on for 30 years. One of the things I know about this conflict is two things. One is that it's completely unpredictable. Second is that the scholars of the conflict are always wrong. And third, that the Palestinians actually have the capability, because they've done it in the past, not for a very long time, in taking initiatives that totally surprise the world and do things that every scholar of international relations would say is totally ridiculous and will never happen. And the key example of that actually was the period, and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas was very much a part of this in 1988, which is they launched something that I call unilateral peacemaking, which is without being asked to, in November of 1988, they unilaterally accepted the petition resolution of 1947, and a month later, without getting any quid pro quo from Israel and only the smallest from the United States, they recognized Israel's right to exist. So they actually, it's been a long time since we've seen creativity and this kind of thrust from the Palestinians, but I don't rule it out. And I would say this, you can naysay every single initiative that anyone will put forward, and you can always make a good case for it. But if you get off of that, I'm an analyst role, and say, all right, I'm going to try to make a change. Then the question is, what is possible? And it's not a question of probable. It's a question of possible. Shibley mentioned the question of the United States and the narrative. Well, things are changing in the United States. Things are changing with respect to domestic politics, with respect to the Congress. My run against Ben Cardin, though it didn't have the results that I wanted, I didn't expect to win. But I wanted a bigger showing. It turned out that the anti-Cardin vote was split seven ways, including Chelsea Manning. But the point is that a lot of things have happened. Our other Maryland senator, Chris Van Hollen, has spoken out in the need for Congress to come out with a resolution against annexation.
Right. And Dr. Talhami, I'm going to give you the last word. We just have about 20 seconds.
Not on this one. I think that's a fair point. But the one point I want to make is on what this Bahrain conference is. It's a mistake to call it an economic development of Palestinians. This isn't. It's by design, if you look at the White House statement, it is to promised investment in case the Palestinians sign an agreement with Israel. So essentially, it's not even about how do we develop now and help the Palestinians now. It is about how many pledges can we get if the Palestinians can get to saying yes, which is one reason why it's already set up that way, sort of to justify the moves. And we shouldn't really bill it as if it's an economic development plan.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. Dr. Shibley Talhami is the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland and a non-resident fellow at Brookings. Ambassador Martin Indyk served as U.S. Ambassador to Israel during the Clinton administration as special envoy to Israeli-Palestinian negotiations during the Obama administration. And Jerome Siegel is the president of the Jewish Peace Lobby. Thanks to you all. I very much appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom.
That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, it's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. We're going to talk to Sharena Christmas, who runs a program called Muse 360 Arts, and we're going to talk about the inequities in summer camp and summers in general here in America. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday Culture Connections. We want to thank the Diz for supplying lunch today. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on the weekends. You can find them on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. Here and Now is coming up at the top of the hour after the news from NPR. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.